You can listen to The Professional Left wherever you get your podcasts, on Netroots Radio, or at our website, proleftpod.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for the week of November 3rd, 2023. It's Not Safe for Work.
Recorded live from the Cornfield Resistance, where it's healthcare re-enrollment week, and oh my God, it's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. Hey, Blue Gal.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right. First of all, let me see. I'm very grateful that we're able to have health insurance.
Same.
Very grateful for the ACA portal, which lets us check whether the insurance we are buying covers our medications and covers our doctors.
Yes. It is a very easy
ahead
to use.
Ahead of time. That's it's all very good.
It's easy to use and gives you all the information you want. And it's,
yep.
It's lovely.
And if you can compare plans and you can shop. And I do recommend that everybody do that. If you are uninsured, you should go to healthcare.gov and it open enrollment started yesterday, and you should definitely do that. Now, that said, me being 60 with significant healthcare needs and Driftglass being 63 as of this week. Happy birthday, Driftglass.
Thank you, Blue Gal. I got quite a birthday present from the insurance company.
Yeah, you sure did. 50% increase in our premiums.
Yep. Boom. Overnight, 50%, and nothing new.
Yeah, our income does not justify. It's not a massive increase in our income that would justify a 50% increase.
Nope.
And the unsubsidized premium, we do get a subsidy.
Right.
The unsubsidized premium per month is over $3,000.
Yeah.
For our plan, and we're taking this. We are renewing our plan, the same plan we have this year. Same deductible, same $5,600 per person deductible, which I think is high. It's a silver plan, but it covers my drugs and it covers my lymphedema care. And everybody that since I've been diagnosed with lymphedema, everyone that I'm working with says, you've got good insurance.
Right. This will do.
And I'm grateful for that. I don't want to say I'm not grateful for that, but now our monthly healthcare premium is more than our mortgage. And we have to hang on by our teeth and hope we don't have to take money out of retirement to pay our health care. And
until I hit 65 and then socialism. Well,
and then you get Medicare and I don't. And apparently that's horrible because then there's a penalty, pretty much the marriage penalty kicks in. And
that's right.
It's bad. So we'll be using the GoFundMe supplemental insurance program and doing a GoFundMe later next year and asking for your support in that. You guys were so great this year when I was diagnosed with this chronic condition, and treatment is going very, very well. I will say it is again. Everyone's told me, oh, you have really good insurance. You know, it covers all of these things that you need to manage this condition. And that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank Jan Schakowsky of Chicago area,
my
congresswoman, who fought for 13 years to get Medicare to cover lymphedema treatment. And my insurance company covers it, even though I just have it because I inherited it and I'm not a cancer patient. Many people get lymphedema due to cancer surgery.
Right.
It's a swelling of the lymph nodes. It's a lack of drainage of fluids and so forth. I just have it because my mom had it. So, I mean, I know why I have it. And the point is that I have good insurance. I'm grateful for that. But I was not prepared for paying 1.5 times what we're paying this year, next year.
Right. For no change in coverage.
For no change in coverage. I mean, really, literally the same coverage.
Yeah.
We looked at switching plans. And again, this was the thing. Oh, well, this isn't covered. This isn't covered. This isn't covered. Your drugs aren't covered. It's like, oh, so it's cheaper, but it's not.
It's not. All these trade-offs. And, you know, we also recognize, and we've said this before many times, because my wife is a genius at health navigation.
Yeah.
And it's helped many, many, many people navigate this complex system.
Yep.
Is that we have the resources, you know, emotionally, mentally to navigate this stuff.
Yeah. And we live in a blue state.
And a lot of people don't. A lot of people really, really don't. This is just overwhelming. And
there have been articles all over the place about people in red states where they haven't expanded Medicaid.
Yeah.
And because of their draconian abortion laws, you know, obstetricians are leaving the state in droves.
Yeah.
And entire counties are having no prenatal care because of the politics of Republican governance. I had assisted Junior Dude in applying for Medicaid in Washington State, a blue state. Mm-hmm. And it was the easiest process I have ever had.
Yep.
I had his pay stub. I had his Social Security number. I had access to his tax returns. Mm-hmm. And I just went click, click, click. And they were like, oh, Medicaid, here you go. You start today.
Yeah, that's it.
And that was it. And within 10 days, he had his Medicaid card. And everybody in Washington takes it.
Of course they do. It's a public option.
It's a public option. It's just oh, good. You have Washington Apple Care, they call it.
Yeah.
Oh, you have Washington Medicaid here. Here's your drugs. Here's your this. Here's your, you know, here's your primary care doctor. He did have a problem meeting with his primary care doctor before January, but you know, that's because
it got worked out. Yeah.
It worked out. It worked out. Yeah, anyway.
And this is, I mean, you know, you and I, mostly you, used to go through the tortures of the damned, making sure that his
monthly
his meds,
his ADHD medication, and his autism drugs, because they're extremely expensive, and the pharmacies would change every week as to whether they took Medicaid this week or that week or whatever. And I had to have a paper prescription because one of his drugs was considered a controlled substance. Mm-hmm. And
wild.
I feel horrible for people now who are dealing with those ADHD drugs because there's such a shortage.
Yeah, absolutely.
And and the thing is, you know, parents of ADHD kids have ADHD.
Yes. They also
and
have
to grind through the step-by-step process on a deadline to get your children the medication they need. Just my blood pressure just went through the roof. And I knew that because every time I had that pill bottle in my hand for the month, I could feel 10 bricks dropping off my shoulders.
Yeah. Well, and this is why, as we've documented on this podcast before, during the whole Affordable Care Act, you know, attempt to kill it 60 plus times by our congressperson and by everybody, every Republican in the House right now, and Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. It was the agonies of the damned. And my wife was in tears. It's just like, if this goes through, we're screwed. I don't know what we're going to do.
Yep.
There's no way for
us to
do this.
We're going to be uninsured is what we're going to do. Yep. We were going to be uninsured.
So, and watching that is why none of our kids is ever going to vote Republican.
Because mom cried. Mom cried.
For no fucking reason. For no reason at all. And it all came down to the thumb of John McCain.
The thumb of John McCain pointing down and saying no. Mm-hmm. And let's do regular order and have an actual bill on the floor that provides something or changes something.
Yep.
You know, there was skinny repeal. Remember that?
Yeah. I remember all of it. That's the problem. I remember all of it.
Yeah.
And
it was one vote by one Republican senator, the Maverick, you know. Mm-hmm. Just saying, and his reasoning was, we didn't do this by regular order. We did it because Trump wanted it. And because the MAGA people wanted to say fuck you to Obama.
Right. And that's the only reason.
And they're all on Medicare. They're all on socialized medicine. They've got theirs. Mm-hmm. We had sticker shock. One of the things we're going to do is something I've been resisting for a long time, but this sticker shock has convinced us that we've got to do this. We're going to start doing some exclusive things for our Patreon donors. Putting up a video from time to time. Driftglass has some writing he's going to put up that will be just for Patreon donors. Mm-hmm. And we have always tried to keep everything for everybody. And we're just to the point that we've got to get those Patreon donations
numbers up. Got to get them up.
We have to, or we're going to go broke. So we will be working harder to provide more content on Patreon. If you want access to that content, patreon.com/proleftpodcast, I think it is.
Mm-hmm. It's been a while.
Professional Left Podcast on Patreon. You'll find it. And we appreciate aging. Everybody who donates, wherever you donate, know that we love you and thank you for that.
And speaking of aging and aging into a new age group, today, this very day, as I'm recording this, is my wife's 19th blogiversary.
19 years ago today, I started blogging. Yeah.
What was going on 19 years ago? You just wanted to get some mommy blog stuff out?
George W. Bush had just been, we believe, reelected. And we weren't sure because it was, Bush free Gore. It was all of that going on in 2000. Actually, no, I think it was 2004. So this was the reelection.
Yeah, this was the reelection. Bush got into office.
Bush versus Kerry.
And Bush won.
Bush won.
A lot of us looked at each other and said, "Oh, the country is as fucked up as we thought." As we were, we thought, "Nah, he
lied us into war. He's not going to be reelected." And he's a
dry drunk
people
disaster.
Don't care.
And I watched that 4 to 6% of undecideds up until just before the election, and you could just feel that I just want to vote for the winner. Yeah. I just want to be a winner and be on the winning team.
And the swift voting of John Kerry was a right-wing political op full of lies. And we see it happening again.
Yes, we do.
With James Comer constantly going on Newsmax with no evidence and no one asks him for any evidence. He's just able to slander Joe Biden and on the regular. In any other instance, if he was talking about a private citizen, he'd be sued out of its house. But he, because of the way the law is, he can say that, you know, Joe Biden's a traitor and he's a money launderer and he's this and that and the other thing. And the Newsmax host goes, "Oh, this is bad.
So bad. Oh my God, this
and
is so bad."
It's Benghazi and Solyndra and the tarmac and the tan suit and the birth certificate and the swift boat, Veterans for Truth.
Well, and later on in this very podcast, not quite right now, because I want to talk about unions for a minute, but later on in this very podcast, we're going to talk about Steve Bannon and an article at Maddow blog about will Republicans ever be held accountable for the 2020 Stop the Steal or blah, 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 blah. And my entire point is Steve Bannon is asking a much too small a question.
Yes, he is.
Will Republicans ever be held accountable for anything?
No.
Anything. No. Lying us into war. Fucking up Katrina. 8 years of trashing Barack Obama. Stealing the Supreme Court. Well, anything. And the answer is no. They will never be held accountable until there's enough people who are sitting on the fence, because the fence is a very comfortable place to be, are grabbed by the scruff of the neck and dragged into the pro-democracy side of the equation. Because Republicans
start voting for their own economic interests as well.
And that's not going to happen until we start making it, you know, very painful for the mainstream media to keep pretending that both sides are equally wrong. Anyway,
let's move on. Thank you for the blogiversary wishes, Driftglass. I appreciate that.
We would like to celebrate not just Blue Gal's blogiversary, which is awesome. And, you know, if you were there at the creation, you're blessed. But the big wins that America's unions are racking up at long last. And thank you, Joseph Robinette Biden, my president. You might remember that Biden took a really big hit as an anti-union turncoat when he asked Congress to implement a collective bargaining agreement between the freight train owners and the IBEW and 11 other railroad-related unions, which several of the unions had legitimately rejected because it didn't cover sick leave, which is totally fair. Not having sick leave on a job that dangerous and exhausting was ridiculous. Biden did this to avert a nationwide shutdown of freight rail just before Christmas during what was already a very fragile economic recovery. And the headlines were all like this or worse. Quote, "Biden signs bill to block U.S. railroad strike," unquote. That's pretty much all anybody heard on the news. He's blocking the shit. He's blocking it. He's against the unions. So he's an anti-worker scab, right? I mean, that's pretty obvious. He's just a scab.
No, he's not.
No.
While President Biden was asking Congress to implement the agreement, this is what he actually said. "I share workers' concern about the inability to take leave to recover from illness or care for a sick family member. I have pressed legislation and proposals to advance the cause of paid leave in my 2 years in office, and I will continue to do so. The Biden White House was playing a longer game. And this year, the unions got their sick leave concessions. Hello?
Yes, they did. They surely did.
And this is what the head of the IBEW Railroad Department said. His name is Al Russo, and he said this, quote, "We are thankful that the Biden administration played the long game on sick days and stuck with us for months after Congress imposed our updated national agreement. Without making a big show of it, Joe Biden and members of his administration in the Transportation and Labor Departments," and that means Pete Buttigieg and former Labor Secretary Marty Walsh.
Boston.
Yep. "They've been working continuously to get guaranteed paid sick days for all railroad workers." Behind the scenes. "We know," and this again is the union guy talking, "we know that many of our members weren't happy with our original agreement, but through it all, we had faith that our friends in the White House and Congress would keep up the pressure on our railroad employers to get us the sick day benefits we deserve." Now, you know who else was working behind the scenes on this? The chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders? I've heard of him.
He's a socialist.
He's a socialist, I hear. Yeah.
Now, he wrote a letter to the leaders of six Class 1 railroads urging them to guarantee at least 7 paid sick days for all of their workers. And union guy Russo is also grateful that Sanders stepped in. "We truly compliment his effort to bring dignity to workers in the rail industry. Without it, we very likely would not have gotten what we have gained today." So the deal is they didn't go on MSNBC and start screaming at the railroads.
No,
they didn't make what we call a federal case out of it. And they allowed this to happen in a way that was organic, and they worked on it and they pressured them and they got it done.
Yeah.
And that was the important thing, was to get it done.
Yeah. Now, and the three takeaways from this article, there's a lot to be taken away, but what are the sentences that jump out at me? Playing the long game, stuck with it for months, and without making a big show of it.
Yeah.
That is the Biden presidency.
Yes,
it is. It's just working it and working it and working it until you find a way to get something done behind the scenes without running into the streets screaming every time something doesn't go your way, or you have to make a compromise, or someone insults you, or someone calls you a doddering old communist Chinese monster. You don't flip out. You don't take the bait every goddamn day. That's what cable news does. That's what it's for. I want that kind of politics going on behind the scenes. I don't need to see. I don't want to see. I don't want to see what's going on every day. I don't have time for it.
Yeah.
I don't want it to be an ant farm where every little thing going on behind closed doors, because you can't negotiate like that.
Right.
You have to sit down behind closed doors and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk until something comes of it. And that's what Biden's been doing for 2 years now. And he hasn't been getting any credit for it, which is terrible. But I'm hoping that at some point it will dawn on at least 1% of the undecided voters in the country that, you know what? Guy's pretty good at being president. He's got some stuff. He knows how to do stuff. He knows how to do political stuff. So if you've been paying attention to Biden's lifelong union bona fides, as we had, you might not have been terribly surprised when he joined striking auto workers in Detroit this September, even though it was the first time, I think, a sitting president had visited the picket line in modern history, maybe ever. I think maybe Teddy Roosevelt did once, but it's unheard of. And he did it. And he was marching with union guys before he was ever president. So this was not a new thing for Joe Biden to do. It was just a new thing for a president to do. And when he did it, he was flanked by UAW President Sean Fain, who called it a historic moment. And these are a few of Joseph Biden's remarks at the scene of the crime, where he was becoming a union thug and siding with, labor. Quote, "You guys, the UAW, you saved the automobile industry back in 2008 and before." And they did. It's absolutely true. You know who didn't save it?
Mitt Romney.
Very good, blue gal. Mitt Romney. Oh, no, private equity will just swing into action, or, let it fail. And no, it was Barack Obama, the Democratic Party, and organizations like the UAW that saved the auto industry and millions of jobs in this country. And of course, you know, but Barack Obama is a Kenyan usurper and Joe Robinette Biden is a doddering old man.
Right.
This is going on with Biden's quote, made a lot of sacrifices, gave up a lot, and the companies were in trouble. But now they're doing incredibly well. And guess what? You should be doing incredibly well, too. That's basic labor fairness 101. Biden told workers they deserve more pay than they're receiving, along with other benefits being advocated for by the union negotiators. Quote, Wall Street didn't build this country. Middle class built the country. Unquote. Now, here's what bugs me about this, Blue Gal.
Yeah.
First of all, Democrats can't message. Democrats are terrible at messaging. They don't know how. And secondly, you know, especially Biden doesn't know how to take one thing that's objectively true and stick with it month after month, year by repetition.
You mean
by
like
sheer
building the middle class upward and outward?
Yes.
Like that?
Like that. Over and over and over again until the press is just sick of it. Until they might actually, goddamn, be forced to report it.
Yeah.
And that would just be the end of the world. But no, this is straight up middle class, pro-labor guy telling people Wall Street ain't the people who built this country. You built it. The middle class built it. And we're going to rebuild the middle class. That's his message.
Yep.
And I don't know why it's so hard for the people in the ivory towers of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times
of the media companies
to understand this, but they don't want to hear it.
Well, they spend all day long with their finger on the pulse of Wall Street, not talking about the middle class. So now, as usual, many of our Never Trump allies went all wobbly because they go all wobbly when any time at all Joe Biden actually does something. It's like,
our friends. These are our friends now.
These are our friends. Did you know, Drift Class, that Joe Biden is old?
I'd heard that. You know what? I hear that literally every time I listen to any Never Trump podcast. And then I hear Democrats don't want to admit it. They don't want to talk about it. Well, yeah, we know it. It's a fact. Talking about it isn't going to change it one way or another. We're aware of it. And other than sitting there pissing yourself on your little podcast, panicking because Democrats don't want to talk about this stuff. What would you like us to do? What would you like us to do?
Well, we know Joe Biden is old. And
yes,
you know
we
what?
Do.
Our minivan is old, too.
It is.
Now, we probably should have traded it in and gotten a Rivian R1S Adventure truck.
Sweet car. Sweet ride. Yeah.
And Drift Class sees these on the road around here.
I do.
Oh, that's a Rivian. We didn't like that. But even as a used car, a Rivian R1S Adventure costs around $95,000.
Yeah.
And that's around $97,000 more than we have to spend on transportation, especially after our health insurance premium jumps.
Yeah, so that ain't going to happen.
By 50%. So we make do with the best available option, which is our 12-year-old minivan. We keep it in good shape, and we pray over it whenever the engine light goes on. We take it to you know, the tire place and have them please plug in their little machine and we cross our fingers real tight and hope they tell us it's nothing. And it gets us from here to there. We mostly drive around in town.
Right.
And that's what we need right now is simply a vehicle that gets us to the grocery store and the post office and the bank and
all we
church,
need.
Right?
Occasionally to St. Louis and maybe
occasionally
upstate
to
somewhere.
St. Louis. That's about it. And we need Joe Biden. That's the fact, because he cares about the middle class and American workers, and he's going to get us there.
Yeah, that's
what
we need.
If we stick with him, he'll get us there.
That's what we need. A reliable vehicle that's a little on the old side. You wish it was a brand new shiny thing, but that's not available right now.
Right.
But you know what? It's going to get us where we need to go, and it'll get us home again. And that's all I ask from any politician.
And maybe protect democracy. We'll see. Yeah,
that'd be great. That'd be awesome. But of course, people like Charlie Sykes, our friend, our ally, who you can't miss him on MSNBC every hour on the air, was warning that Biden was walking the picket line, was very risky. It was very, very risky. Fox News went nuts and the mainstream media did what it was trying to do, what it does all the time, which is split the difference, you know, right down the middle. Now, these are some Fox News headlines. Fox News, Biden is sinking like a stone and UAW members are staying on the sidelines this time. And Fox News, again, reporters piled on frustrated Karine Jean-Pierre over Biden's plan to join UAW picket line. Now, the article goes on to mention that it was basically, I watched the thing. It was a couple of reporters asking her questions about negotiating tactics. And she said, we're not going to talk about what we think should be in the contract while we're negotiating. But the tenor was, you know, Biden's flailing. He's dropping like a stone. He's desperate. He's so desperate. He's willing to walk out and walk with strikers on a picket line. And that's why he's a loser. He's a big loser man. And you know what? Joe Biden, once again, bet on the middle class and the UAW, and he won. And that's the story. This is from Reuters. Quote, the UAW won from GM roughly the same package of wage increases agreed to by the other two automakers. Pay for veteran workers will rise by 33%, and GM will give $2,500 in five payments to retirees through 2028. This contract reverses years of efforts by GM to create lower paid groups of UAW workers at units such as component plants, parts warehouses, and electric vehicle battery operations. Union President Sean Fain said some workers at GM component factories will get pay increases of as much as 89%. The contract,
because in 2008, they were willing to work for anything.
Yeah, for anything at all.
And the auto companies took advantage of that and paid them really low.
They did.
And it's time for that to stop.
And hoping it would last forever. But yeah, it's not going to. The contract also restricts use of lower paid temporary workers. Quote, we have slammed the door on having a permanent underclass of temporary workers at GM, Fain said. The UAW also gained more sway over the company's investments decisions by securing the right to strike over future plant closures.
So Bidenomics works again.
Mm-hmm.
And Bidenomics is the end of Reaganomics.
Yes.
I want to be clear about that. Mm-hmm. In related news, the National Labor Relations Board passed a wonky rule that is worth celebrating. And I talked with you about this, Driftglass, when it happened earlier this week, and how the details are complicated, but the outcome is not, and how important it is that there are wonky people working in government, making adjustments and rules and changes at the administrative level.
Right.
And this is where, you know, Donald Trump wants to fire all of these people.
That's
and
right.
Simply have a fascistic Trump state, because he calls these people deep state people. But they're actually people who know how things work and how to tweak them to make them work better for people.
Mm-hmm.
And so this new rule from the NLRB says that if a company hires you via a franchise or temp agency or other employment agency, they cannot stop you from organizing a union at your workplace. Common Dreams reports, the new rule, said People's Parity Project co-founder Sejal Singh, would help anyone in the U.S. who has ever technically worked for a weird staffing agency or a sketchy subcontractor instead of the company that determined their pay and work responsibilities. For those employees, said Singh, it just got easier to organize a union. Veteran union organizer Craig Peck added that companies that rely on franchisees to operate their business, such as McDonald's, and corporations that hire certain workers through contracting companies like Amazon. Now, think about the percentage of American workers who have worked either at McDonald's or Amazon over the course of their careers. It's the majority.
Yeah, absolutely.
They could now be required to negotiate with a union formed at the franchise or contractor if the NLRB determines they jointly employ the unionized workers. In other words, we hired these guys. They work for us and no one else.
Mm-hmm.
They're our workers. That means if they form a union, we have to recognize that.
That's right.
Giants like Amazon and McDonald's can't hide behind loopholes anymore, said labor rights media organization More Perfect Union. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, wait a minute.
We
just talked about him.
Him again? How's he getting all this love from
us? He's doing everywhere. He's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he is the chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee.
Mm-hmm.
He has a lot of power, people.
He does. He really does.
Said the new standard, and again, this is being done at the administrative level.
Mm-hmm.
This new standard will, quote, help ensure corporations cannot avoid their responsibility to collectively bargain with their workers and will help restore fairness to an economy rigged against workers, unquote. Mm-hmm. So now, this is good news. And again, personnel matters. The people that are working in the Labor Relations Board, the people that are working in the economic sector of the Biden administration, these are Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren people.
Yes, they are.
And that's why you're getting things like Build Back Better, which, by the way, is on the back burner. It's not it's not gone forever.
No.
When we get the House back and hopefully, God willing, keep the Senate, it will come back.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is, as you were saying, this is about the wonky technical details of everything the government does.
Below, and you can believe that McDonald's and Amazon have lawyers that know about these loopholes and how to exploit them.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. This is what happened with the housing crisis. The fact that the regulators were regularly outspent, 1,000 to 1 by the companies they were trying to regulate, and were always trying to get work with them once they retired. So they were willing to look the other way and scuff up the rules, let them get away with murder because I want to go work for Lehman.
Yeah.
And locally, I will just tell you one brief story locally. Permitting here is a weird problem. There are people
in Springfield.
Yeah. You try to open a business, especially in certain locations, it's like there's old buildings, there's historic buildings, there's stuff you can't do. There's all kinds
of
zoning.
Especially downtown. It's all old buildings downtown.
Yeah. And I know of a couple of cases where someone thought they had all the clearances. The people they talked to said, yeah, you're clear, everything's fine, your structure's fine, everything's fine. And the minute they started working, another department swept in and said, oh, no. Your HVAC system isn't up to standards, or you can't have a kitchen here.
You can't have
something.
A stove here. Yes, I remember that. Oh, we opened a restaurant. No, you can't have a stove in the back of this building.
Sorry, can't have a stove here. Nope. It's insane. Yeah. It's insane. And it's from decades and decades of the wrong people being in charge of the government,
right,
putting in all these regulations to favor what they want to do, which is real estate.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a guy at the city hall who knows all this stuff, who's the permitting guy. And this group I worked with as a volunteer, one of the events we held was essentially taking him out of his office and putting him in a public venue that we lined up and just having people come ask him questions. If you want to know how to open a business in Springfield, here's a guy who can tell you a lot of good stuff you might need to know. And people were lined up to ask this guy questions, and he was thrilled because he hadn't been out of his office in like 25 years.
Yeah,
it's like it never occurred to anyone to take this wonky guy, who's the guy who knows how this all works, and put him in a public forum.
Yep.
Instead, it was to stick him away in a cubicle on the third floor behind, a chalkboard.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to ask around and find out who he is and what he
Seriously.
Knows. Seriously. And
And the number one person who's going to open a restaurant downtown is somebody who already owns a restaurant someplace else.
Absolutely.
And they want to know, what hoops do I have to jump through? Because I'd like that downtown traffic.
Yes.
And I'd like that downtown atmosphere for my second restaurant. So what do I do?
Yeah.
And so you provided that service. That's terrific. Yeah.
And we have a bunch of younger entrepreneurs and openers. Where there's a wine bar that just opened downtown, a couple of restaurants, things like that, a market. There's a lot of people of that age cohort just below you and I who have kids who want to live here and would like to open a business here. And they're very
sincere
about it.
And make a lot of
it.
Money downtown with serving wine and food and crafts and whatever. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they're constantly stubbing their toe on this and that. And finding the people who know what they're talking about and bringing them to the forefront is a good thing. And those
and you
are the
can
people-
bet you that Bernie Sanders knows the people over at the National Labor Relations Board.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, God. Anyway, I kind of got off the subject.
Yeah, right, right.
Getting back to the UAW for a second. Sean Fain isn't resting on his laurels, my dear.
Okay.
This latest victory is not his last victory. This is via the New York fucking Times. Quote, laying out a tentative contract agreement to end a six-week wave of walkouts at Ford Motor, the UAW president made an unusual pitch to other labor unions. Well, are we all going to dress the same now? No. Quote, we invite unions around the country to align your contract expirations with our own, the UAW leader Sean Fain said Sunday night.
Quote, oh, my God.
I know. Like, oh, there's a plan. Oh, crap. Now they're going to form like a mega union. Oh, no.
Oh, jeez.
If we're going to truly take on the billionaire class and, wait for it, rebuild the economy so that it starts to work for the benefit of the many, not the few. This guy knows Bernie. He's on speed dial.
He knows Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. And he has great faith in Joe Biden.
In Joe Biden, yeah.
Mr. Fain added, then it's important that we not only strike, but we strike together. together. Kaboom. Yeah, union, another word for together. While it remains to be seen whether other unions follow the UAW's lead, Mr. Fain's invitation highlights the sweeping ambition of the union strategy during the recent strike, the first to target all three Detroit automakers simultaneously. The article goes on, beyond seeking the largest wage and benefit increases in decades and a reversal of the concessions the union made during the company's downturn, such as lower wage tiers for newer workers, Mr. Fain repeatedly spoke of fighting for, quote, the entire working class, unquote. Damn. Love to hear that. You love to hear that. And yeah. I didn't want to get lost in the mix because this is all good news. That did you know that the Hollywood writers' strike was settled, Lou Gow?
Yeah. The writers' strike is over. Now the Actors Guild isn't. Is that right?
No,
they're still
that's right.
They're still negotiating, I take it.
Yeah, but there's a lot of I'm not a Hollywood expert. I'm not a union Hollywood expert. I do know that the writers got a lot of what they asked for because they were in solidarity with each other and they had the actors on their side. Now the actors would like a little consideration, and apparently one of the things that wealthy actors have agreed to is lifting the cap on dues.
Oh, yeah.
Because apparently there's a limit on the amount you pay, on the percentage of your salary. But if you're making a gazillion dollars a year, you can afford a little bit more to help
the
union.
If you're making Marvel money, you get to pay a little more. Yeah.
But apparently they're willing to do that. I also wanted to add that all of this reminded me a little bit of Joe Biden's speech in September of 2022 about democracy. Mm. Remember that speech, Blue Gal? Mm-hmm. It was a speech about democracy. He held it in front of Independence Hall, as I recall.
Oh, yeah, and he had red flags behind him, and everybody was talking about the staging of it and complaining about it.
The red lights and the Marine Guard.
The right-wing photoshopped him looking like it was a Nazi stage. Yeah.
It was just the normal thing. It was just and it was a speech on defending democracy. Mm-hmm. And our allies, again, these never-Trumpers, I wrote about it at the time, just fell out over it. It was bad timing, bad lighting. Joe Biden should not have mentioned the Democratic agenda. It's way too alarmist, way too freaked out. You know, Josh Barrow was just having kittens over this thing about, you know, this is just a normal election coming up. Just quit trying to do blah, 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 blah. And they wagged their fingers at Joe Biden for not telling the DCCC to stop interfering in Republican primaries, which.
And that's when we had a tremendous red wave, right?
Right. There was going to be a red wave. And these Democrats, if they really believe in democracy, and this is all of our allies, this was all of all these people at the Bulwark, all of our Never Trump friends were like, how dare Democrats be such hypocrites? If they believe in democracy, quit fiddling in Republican primaries. Well, it happened in like six of them, not 100 of them. And in every case, it worked. And in every case, the thing the Democrats did that was terrible was run ads saying so-and-so believes in this and this and this and this and this, which were all true.
All those true.
So-and-so is too conservative for our state.
Right.
That was it. That was the sneaky tactic Democrats were using. It worked. And by the way, it was one of the many tactics Democrats used to turn the red wave into a red trickle and turn Kevin McCarthy into a cabbage head. Didn't last for more than a couple of Scaramucci's in speaker. It worked. Democratic Party tactics worked, but they were freaked out that Joe Biden wasn't ordering Democrats to stop doing this, that he should have used the speech to do this, because you know what? It's just an ordinary election. Democracy is not at stake, blah, 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 blah. Now, of course, these same people are having kittens over the fact that democracy is at stake.
Yeah.
And why isn't Joe Biden shaking his fist and working harder, blah, 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 blah? Because that's all they do. Biden is either doing too much or not enough.
Too
by
much
the way,
or not enough.
And he's old. I don't know if you knew that, Blue Gal. He's an old
God.
Guy. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
All right. I want to take a moment in this podcast with a word about children and building the middle class. There is a book review in the October 30th issue of The New Yorker that includes a review of the new book called The Two-Parent Privilege by Melissa Kearney. She is a professor of economics at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Mm-hmm. Now, this book is wonky. Again, she's not talking about, when she talks about the two-parent privilege, she's not shitting on single moms.
No.
She is an economist looking at numbers.
Right.
And making an economic argument about data. Okay.
And you should also know that this is something my wife read to me in bed.
I did. I read this to him in bed. Because it matters to me. Children matter to me.
Absolutely.
Raising children matters to me. I was a single mom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I married Driftglass, I instantly saw that my children's lives improved, in part because there was another pair of hands to make lunches and drive kids to school.
Double your labor force.
Yeah. Yep. And boy, does it make it easier. It just does. Being a single mom is hard. And I know that there are single moms out there listening to us. And I'm with you. It is. This is hard work. And God bless you for doing it. But this book, which is making a lot of buzz around, discusses something that Driftglass has been saying for years, which is that marriage as an institution is a machine built for raising children.
Yes.
And that is the purpose of marriage in terms of the building blocks of our society.
Right. Period.
Taking all of the emotion and the word should out of it. Mm-hmm. Because that it is nothing. There's nothing in here about what people should do. Mm-hmm. It's simply about the building blocks of what our society does and how that building block performs. And I hope I'm being clear about this because this triggers everybody into thinking someone's judging my lifestyle, and that's not what this book is about.
But this describing book. Describing a black box.
This book is making a judgment about how privileged people who are married are.
Yes.
And what economically privileged.
And what can be
and
done
whether
about
it's chicken and egg, whether they're privileged because they were able to get married because they can't afford a house, which is what I argue. If you can already afford a house, you're much more likely to get married. Or if marriage in it of itself is a benefit that proves your privilege. This is what she's exploring in her book. And so I'd like to read a section from this review in the New Yorker. It's the latest issue, the October 30th issue. Mm-hmm. Having two parents who are married to each other, Kearney argues, provides offspring with an advantage that is becoming yet another privilege associated with more highly resourced groups in society. By joining their particular strengths, a married couple can give their progeny more than the sum of their parts. As a concept, this principle mirrors the genius of the assembly line in production and manufacturing, she writes. She also acknowledges that her calculations about the relationship between partner resources, parental income, wealth, time, and emotional energy, and a child's outputs, the level of education that child attains, and their own ultimate earning power as grown-ups later, may present a cognitive challenge for readers who aren't accustomed to thinking about raising children in the same terms that are used to describe a car factory. Mm-hmm. Okay, and again, I get that. It's difficult to think of your kids as a car. But as an economist, this is how she's looking at it. She's saying the output you want in a family is successful children that can support themselves, that can be functional members of society. Right. And my parents talked about that all the time, paying their debt to society. We don't talk about that anymore, but that was a big thing to them, was raising educated children was their goal. So Kearney insists that she is not blaming single mothers. Nope. She is not dismissing the effects of structural racism or saying that everyone should marry. She's not calling for a reinstatement of the model 1950s household with a waged father and a stay-at-home mom. She does not suggest, like some cultural critics before her, that the increase in out-of-wedlock birth rates is a signal of moral decline in America. I think David Brooks could enter this conversation all of a sudden. She's also not arguing that there's a willfully individualistic flouting of tradition going on. Right. That's, again, none of that. Rather, and this to me is amazing, and this is why I read it to you, Driftglass. Kearney points to how the decline of manufacturing in the United States and the rise of lower paid, more precarious working conditions at auto plants... has made it much harder for blue-collar males to sustain an adequate and reliable standard of living. This is Reaganomics, screwing the workers, rendering them less inclined to marry.
Right.
Because they can't afford it. They can't afford a house, a roof over their own heads. So they're not going to start a family. It also disinclines them to stay married. And they are less appealing as marriage material in the first place. All because the manufacturing sector was hollowed out by Ronald Reagan and Reaganomics.
Yep.
In some of the most compelling passages in her book, Kearney explores research on the impact of financial strain on cognitive functioning. There's evidence that children of parents who are poorer and more consumed by stress may be shortchanged, not only materially, but emotionally. Among Kearney's recommendations for closing the daunting marriage gap are policy changes that would scale up community-based programs that strengthen and increase economic support for low-income families. That means Build Back Better.
Mm-hmm.
That
Absolutely.
Means the child care tax credit. That means union jobs.
Yeah.
For men and women.
It means raising taxes on the highest wealth people in the country and highest, most profitable
corporations.
And making
sure that housing is available
and
for parents of children.
It's all the GI Bill stuff.
And there would be no baby boom without the GI Bill.
Right.
Giving money. This is giving money to people.
Right.
Money for housing, money for education, money for starting a business.
Yeah.
And yes, absolutely, the GI Bill was racist.
It was. Straight up.
And there is structural racism. And there is economic inequality between whites and blacks. And there is blaming single moms for the state of their children's education all the time.
But there's also a lesson to be learned from the success of the GI Bill for
yes,
what it
exactly.
was.
Exactly.
And a replicable model. I mean, all the models we need are to be found in the Roosevelt administration and the Johnson administration and the Truman administration.
And I'm not necessarily arguing that we need another baby boom.
No,
frankly,
not at all.
We need more immigrants in the United States.
Yes, we do.
We need
a lot more.
But the fact is that children benefit from a more stable economy among parents.
Absolutely.
And people of childbearing age deserve that support.
Well, and before I was even a blogger, Blue Gal, can you believe that? There was a time before I was even a blogger. I would bore people at parties, or I would talk to people at the places I went. When the subject came up, which is frequent, that the nuclear family was an unholy creation. I'm a product of a nuclear family, so are you.
Yep.
I love my mom, and I love my father, and then divorced and remarried, et cetera, et cetera. But the nuclear family was and is inherently unstable.
Yeah.
Because it reduces the machine to raise children down to two laborers, one who goes out of the world to make enough money to keep the roof over their heads and feed them. And
you're talking about the 1950s traditional family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one who raises the children. Mm-hmm. Those are the two functions of a household, to provide economic security that keeps the household intact and to raise the next generation. That's the function. If you don't have any kids, that's fine. That you still qualify. That's just not one of your responsibilities. But that is the goal of a family. And the goal of the family was, the shape of the family was radically altered after and during World War II, when after World War II, it became much more advantageous to have highly mobile little families. You could move around the country to work for corporations. You move into the suburbs where there's a lot of people just like them. That worked great as long as you had a continually growing economy and everybody was making money and everybody was doing okay by the standards of the time.
And again, we're only talking about white people.
Right. Only talking about white people. Only talking about a very, very small slice of history. Before that, the typical family was an extended family in a smaller town.
It was the Waltons.
It was the Waltons.
Yes.
You know, when we moved back from overseas, we didn't move into the suburbs immediately. We moved in with my mom's mom and dad.
Yeah.
And we had aunts and uncles and grandparents and us and cousins. And you know what? If one person got sick, if my mom got sick or my aunt got sick, there's another parent or another adult there to step in and take up some of the slack. It was a more stable. It was not as mobile. It couldn't be used like you deploy army units wherever you need them, whenever you need them. If you get a job in Texas, you go to Texas, you take your family with you. It was a much more corporate-friendly structure. And that's why you built suburbs around cities so that these little units could live within train distance or driving distance of the job. And that works great as long as there's no economic situation that breaks the model. like, let's say, the oil shock of the 1970s and massive inflation and massive unemployment and recessions. And when that happened, a small town family with a lot of family members and the adults, the extended family, can survive those shocks. Mm-hmm. They can endure them. Nuclear families shatter because suddenly mom has to leave the house to make money. And who's going to raise the kids? And then you have to offload those responsibilities onto somebody else.
Yeah.
And it becomes impossible to manage. My parents got divorced in the 70s.
Yeah.
There are a lot of reasons about it, but a lot of parents started getting divorced. A lot of people, because of economic stress on the family that made everything else unendurable.
Right.
And it is simply a fact that since we are not going to recreate extended families in small towns, but we do want healthy children and we do want healthy families in healthy communities, we have got to scale up, just like the article says, community-based programs that strengthen and increase economic support for low-income families. We have to. That's the only way a family unit can survive. And you can organize families in a whole bunch of different ways. Robert Heinlein has a lot of fun organizing lion families and blended families and molded families. This is a judgment on none of the ways families are organized.
Not gay families or extended families with aunts living there or uncles living upstairs or whatever.
It's all good.
Doesn't matter.
It's all good.
That's not part of this book. Yeah.
It's when the basic function of the family is to provide economic sustainability for the family itself and raise the next generation. When that breaks, everything else breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
And we're living through that because the economy got hollowed out in the 80s.
Yeah.
And manufacturing jobs went away. And some of that was inevitable, but a lot of it wasn't. And a lot of it was based on Reaganomics, which has got to fucking go.
It's got to die. It's got to die.
Shall we do a news roundup?
Yes. The President Bidening continues.
Now, this isn't news, but it was fun to watch. It was fun to watch Donald Trump turn on Maggie Haberman, his Boswell. You know, I'm sorry, Maggot Hagerman. That was delightful. And to watch him turn on the Federalist Society, that was awesome and predictable. And if you want to know how predictable, go over to No More Mr. Nice blog, who predicted this months ago.
Yep. He did a big, I told you so column at his blog. And it's going to be really interesting to see. I mean, you said yourself, Leonard Leo doesn't care.
No, he doesn't care.
He got the Supreme Court he wanted.
Right.
And Trump's going to die eventually. And and Leonard Leo will still be sitting on $1 billion.
Right. To do whatever he wants. Right.
And so he'll wait.
Right.
And if, God forbid, Trump is reelected and decides to go against the Federalist Society, you know, there's going to be a lot of resistance to him appointing anyone to the Supreme Court. But let's just not reelect Trump. How about that?
That's a great answer to a lot of
anyone listening to this podcast nightmares.
Yeah.
Driftglass, there are a couple of breaking news stories that came through my email that I'd like to insert here.
Okay.
Briefly.
Go ahead.
Axios reports that major landlords nationwide are effectively colluding to keep rents high. DC's attorney general argues in a new lawsuit.
No. It's Biden and Biden's inflation, and it's all Biden's fault.
No, DC is filing a lawsuit that argues that using the RealPage software to set rents amounts to a cartel in which buildings that ought to be competing for renters are instead all using the same computer program to set rents.
Mm-hmm.
And that is keeping rents high. So that lawsuit still has to go forward. But, you know, some people are paying attention to landlord cartels keeping rents high.
Yeah, good.
Then in a related story, there was a verdict 10 hours ago. A Kansas City jury took just 3 hours to find that the National Association of Realtors conspired with two of the nation's largest housing brokerages to keep commissions on home sales high. The decision puts defendants on the hook for $1.8 billion.
Oh.
With the possibility of triple damages.
Yeah, I was going to say treble damages. Yep, yep.
It could also shake up the business of buying and selling homes.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Right now, sellers typically pay a fee of 5 to 6% of a home sale price. That money is split between the seller's agent and the buyer's agent.
Mm-hmm.
The plaintiffs argued that the National Association of Realtors and its co-defendants conspired to keep those rates high and that the system prevents sellers or buyers from negotiating the fees down. This case is likely to drag out for a while. They're going to appeal, blah, blah, blah. But this sort of thing, as it settles out, is likely to spur fee competition between brokers. And competition is a great way to bring prices down. This is what Axios says. If the jury's verdict is upheld, the plaintiffs have also asked the judge to establish a remedy. Quote, to take a page from Gwyneth Paltrow, this could mean that fees get consciously uncoupled.
Okay.
Sellers pay their real estate agent and buyers pay their person, and each negotiates that fee down. So, you know, and this will have an effect on housing prices. So people, these lawsuits and these things that are going forward, people are really looking at who's being greedy here.
Right.
And how do we fix that? And I think that's just terrific.
Well, let me just tag on to that. What we watched last night with your friend, Elizabeth Warren, on television.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about, you know, Elizabeth, what's causing all this inflation? She went down a whole list of things. And very near the top was greedy corporations,
greedy
price
corporations.
Gouging.
Yeah,
they're just jacking up prices because they can. I mean, that's it's not supply and demand. It's corporations deciding, screw it. We're going to charge twice what we used to. What are you going to do about it?
Right. Yeah. Right. And speaking of greed, Trump's lawyer, Alina Haba, claims that Donald Trump can't be jailed for violating his gag order because he is protected by the Secret Service. And the Secret Service isn't going to let him go to jail. No, he's going to be able to put him in jail because the Secret Service will stop that.
Well,
so don't worry, MAGA, she said on Newsmax.
So let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. When he dies of whatever cause, do they have to bury him with Secret Service agents so that they will go to go to hell with him? It seems a little unfair to force those guys.
I am going
to
be interested to see what happens when he dies.
Military prison. Oh, I'm sorry. No. For jailing purposes.
No,
military
just,
prison.
State funeral?
No. Military prison for him as he lives.
No. Military prison is the obvious answer.
Yeah, clear out a wing.
And the judge has to work with the Secret Service, but the Secret Service isn't going to move into the prison to protect him.
No. Military prison with, you know, three rooms and three bunks, and one of them is Trump and two Secret Service on either side.
No.
Boom.
No.
Done. Finished.
No. They'll just have a separate wing for him, and he'll have to stay there with no phone. But I'm interested in what happens when he dies. State funeral?
Oh, no. No.
I don't think so.
A MAGA torchlit parade.
A MAGA
down
torch.
Yeah. With tiki torches and Nazi salutes. And I assume they'll embalm him and try to lay him in state like Stalin.
In a golf course.
Or like Lenin.
They'll bury him at a golf course for tax breaks. His kids will bury him at a golf course for tax breaks. You know they will.
Yeah. On Tuesday, Ohio voters will decide whether to protect access to abortion in their state. The measure on the ballot, known as Issue 1, which is, you know, way appropriate, would change the state's constitution to provide the right for every person to, quote, make and carry out one's own reproductive decisions, unquote, before a fetus is viable outside the womb, usually around 23 to 24 weeks of pregnancy. If Issue 1 passes, Ohio will become the latest state to vote to protect or expand abortion access. Since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year, abortion rights have gone 6-for-6 in elections, including in red states, when voters have made direct decisions on the issue. This is
don't sleep on the Virginia state house elections next Tuesday also, because abortion is on the ballot in Virginia, and it's on the ballot in the form of electing Democrats to the state legislature. They're all up for re-election.
And the new Speaker of the House is pro-forced birth. Under every circumstance.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
And according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the House Republican plan to fund $14 billion in emergency aid for Israel with cuts to the IRS so that billionaire tax cheats can be free to do whatever they're doing would end up costing taxpayers $26 billion over 10 years.
Yeah. Mike Johnson doesn't understand that math because Mike Johnson has a lot of problems.
Yes,
we're
going
to get
to
those in just a minute. Meanwhile, on the other side of the political aisle, the Biden administration will spend $1.3 billion to build, mind you, three large electrical transmission lines across six states to upgrade the nation's power grid so it can better handle more renewable energy, as well as extreme weather. You know, like they had in Texas when Texas froze and Ted Cruz ran away like a little bitch. The lines, built with money from the bipartisan infrastructure law, will span from Arizona to New Mexico, Nevada to Utah, and through Vermont and New Hampshire and into Canada. Together, the three transmission lines will add 3.5 gigawatts. 3.5 gigawatts!
3.5 gigawatts!
Or gigawatts. Of additional electricity capacity to the grid, enough to power about 3 million homes and create roughly 13,000 new jobs.
Go electrical union workers. All right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. By the way, Donald Trump has proposed free college for everyone.
Which is so great. I'm voting for him. I heard the details.
We watched Hal Sparks on this last night, Wednesday night. Donald Trump's proposal is he's invented DeVry University.
Yeah.
For everyone.
Everyone. It'll be great. He'll pay for it by seizing the means of production, all the money and endowments and property of existing Ivy League schools, and use it to launch some hybrid of Trump University, PragerU, and Barry Weiss's Substack University of Advanced Phrenological Studies.
Yes.
And he also says it's going to be great. It's going to be online. It's going to be so easy. It'll be ready in 2 weeks. We're going to teach Stephen Miller's 1776 book.
None of this woke stuff.
It won't be woke. It'll be pro-America.
That's right.
And it'll be accepted as certification and accredited throughout the country because America.
Because I say so.
it's just slapping another.
It'll be ready in 2 weeks.
2 weeks. 2 weeks at maximum 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It's just like healthcare.
Yeah.
According to his financial disclosures of the past 7 years, the new Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson and his wife and children have no checking accounts, no savings accounts, and no investments of any kind. They're living off the grid, Blue Gal. I don't know how they're doing it. Living on a prayer, I guess. But
they also have a history of being pro gay conversion therapy.
Oh, yeah. His wife was in the business, I believe. I think she was, that was her stock and trade for a while.
Yeah.
It's just everything is bad about him. Every inch they dig down through the topsoil of his nice suit and his
and
well-parted
hair. And all I'm
going to say
is I am sensing huge Marcus Bachmann energy radiating from this guy. That's all I'm going to say.
It's bad.
More on Mike Johnson. Before Mike Johnson was elected to public office, he was the dean of a small Baptist law school that didn't exist. The establishment of the Judge Paul Pressler School of Law was supposed to be a capstone achievement for Louisiana College, which administrators boasted would unashamedly embrace a biblical worldview. Instead, it collapsed roughly a decade ago without enrolling students or opening its doors amid infighting by officials. Accusations of financial impropriety and difficulty obtaining accreditation, which frightened away would-be donors.
Oh, no.
Now, a side note on this. My ex-husband taught at Samford University Law School, Samford University is a Baptist college. And the undergraduate school is Baptist, Baptist, Baptist. And the law school is decidedly not.
Yeah.
And the reason is accreditation.
Exactly.
And getting the Bar Association to recognize your law school as legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no indication that Mike Johnson engaged in wrongdoing while employed by the private college, which is now known as Louisiana Christian University. But as a virtually unknown player in Washington, the episode offers insight into how Johnson navigated leadership challenges that echo the chaos, feuding, and hard right politics that have come to define the Republican House majority he now leads.
Yeah,
that's from the AP. And I got to say, it all fell apart because of the biblical worldview part of the law school.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but,
the Bar Association looked at that and went, huh?
No, the fact that, Paul said it doesn't overrule legal precedent. Sorry, doesn't work
and
that
also,
way.
Also, where's the bank account?
Yeah, well, that's
that you put your paycheck into.
That's a really, maybe, I don't know. That's a good question. There's a whole lot of questions about Mike Johnson we will be hearing about over the next, 6 months or until he's run out of town. But it's got to be goddamn entertaining while it lasts. Joe Biden, meanwhile, invoked emergency federal powers to assert oversight of artificial intelligence systems, part of an executive order aimed at safeguarding against threats posed by what he called, quote, the most consequential technology of our time, unquote.
And Michigan just passed laws this week banning deepfakes in political advertising. Yeah. So
good for them.
Hopefully that happens in the federal level as well at some point. Now, Senate Democrats have announced a plan to subpoena three wealthy and influential conservatives who provided Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito with luxury travel.
Mm-hmm.
Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee, thank you, Sheldon Whitehouse, said they would subpoena Harlan Crowe, Leonard Leo, and a person named Robin Arkley II, who I'm sure wishes he wasn't associated with Harlan Crowe and Leonard Leo, for documents as part of their investigation into ethics reform at the Supreme Court. Quote, by accepting these lavish, undisclosed gifts, the justices have enabled their wealthy benefactors and other individuals, and here's the money quote, with business before the court,
yep,
to gain private access to the justices while preventing public scrutiny of this conduct, Senate Judiciary Committee said. And so they're going to subpoena these guys. We'll see what happens.
And there's one more item, and I want to add one more item after that, if you don't mind. Josh Hawley, you might know him from, he's from our neighboring state of Missouri, which is an embarrassment to the nation.
Really, he's not. He lives in other states, but he says he's from Missouri.
Yeah.
His sister's house is in Missouri. Yeah.
He got his ass absolutely handed to him in public by Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and good for him.
And you love to see it, because Mayorkas has been such a whipping boy for Marjorie Taylor Greene and Josh Hawley and all these other assholes. And it's just not right.
I didn't want this podcast to pass without mentioning that people got very bent out of shape, myself included, because 31 Democrats voted with Republicans to not expel George Santos from the House this week. And I was like, what the hell, man? I mean, just, you know, was the catapult broken or something? Because there's got to be a way to get this lunatic the hell out of there. And then Jamie Raskin, who voted to keep him in the House or not eject him, explained in very small words, slowly, so that I could understand it, why he did what he did. I went, oh, okay, that makes sense. And he said, look, in the history of the House, there have been 5 people ejected from the House.
Mm-hmm.
3 for treason during the Civil War,
mm-hmm,
and 2 for criminal conduct that they were convicted of.
So they went to court and they were found guilty.
Kicked out. George Santos, who we know is guilty of so many things, including baby theft, I'm thinking, is guilty of sin, but not before a court of law or before the ethics committee. And Jamie Raskin said, look, if we do this, it will set a dangerous precedent where you can kick someone out of the House of Representatives if you're in the majority just because you want to. And that is not a good enough reason for him to vote to get rid of George Santos. I also think having Santos there hanging around their neck like an albatross is a lovely, lovely Thanksgiving present for them. But
for Democrats,
I changed my mind. Jamie,
especially in upstate New York, where they're the ones that want to kick him out. So they're not sharing a ballot with him in primary time.
Jamie Raskin used his words to change my mind. Mm-hmm. I haven't changed my mind about George Santos or his guilt or his complete unfitness to be in any government agency at all. But I do agree that setting a precedent of kicking people out who haven't been convicted of anything is a bad precedent to set.
And I got to say, all this impeachment talk from the House on Hannity and on Newsmax, you know, Jamie Raskin and Dan Goldman are sitting in that House chamber.
Yeah.
They have experience in impeachment.
Yep.
They have experience in prosecution. And they have brains in their heads and know how to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
Which you have pointed out many times, is a very important skill to have.
It is very important in politics and in life. Yes.
And my feeling about impeaching Joe Biden in an election year is go ahead.
Go ahead. Do it. Do it.
You know, James Comer he wants to go on Newsmax and call Joe Biden a money laundering traitor, but he doesn't want to have any hearings.
Right.
Because Dan Goldman will be there.
Yeah.
And Dan Goldman makes me look like an idiot.
Yeah. Every night, James Comer wakes up terrified that Dan Goldman's behind the door.
And Jamie Raskin is on the other side of the door.
If you want to scare the crap out of him on Halloween, show up dressed as Jamie Raskin or Dan Goldman. And
he's having his hearings on Newsmax.
Right. No, we don't want any candy. We'd like evidence, if you don't mind. That evidence. Would be great. You ever get any evidence?
But no one asked me for evidence on Newsmax.
Yeah. And the way
the thing is, we all, and please, we, one of the things this podcast tries to do is give people vocabulary.
Yes.
We're talking about impeaching Joe Biden. The only response you need is ridicule.
Yeah, that's it. You don't need to ask.
It's Benghazi Solyndra. Eat your heart out.
Yeah. Well, great. You know, because as you know, attempting to impeach Bill Clinton ruined him.
Oh, and ruined the Democratic Party for decades.
Ruined him. Ruined, wrecked his popularity.
No. Nope.
Just screwed him up real bad. He came out swinging.
No, it didn't.
But please, go after you.
Proceed, Congressman. Proceed. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Love to hear it.
We have some local news, Drift Glass.
Yeah. If you're planning to celebrate Thanksgiving with pumpkin pie, here's what you should know. Chances are the pumpkin is from Illinois. That's right. It's here. We don't live near a pumpkin patch, but it is from Illinois. It's true. We're not just corn and soybeans and an awesome governor. We're also number one in pumpkin production in the nation. Illinois estimated 650 million pound crop this year is expected to stimulate the economy across the state. That and weed are we're filling the coffers of our wonderful governor.
No pumpkin spice weed, please.
No, that's unholy. Don't even think about that, Miguel.
Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Lou Costello, who in this picture is enjoying a moment of zen, which he has pretty frequently in his life. Let me tell you, he's a calm, affectionate cat who weighs 22 pounds and nobody and nothing is going to bother him. We have like that.
We know about cats like
that. Barack Hussein, the Kenyan usurper, is totally at peace with the world.
He is sleeping comfortably about 4 feet away from me right now.
Yeah, and if Olive, the younger all-black cat, wants to eat from his bowl, he just steps aside and waits and comes back later. Because,
You go ahead. You go ahead.
Whatever. I weigh three times what you do, and I could swat you like a bug, but you're a wee thing. I'll just let you eat. Go ahead.
You know, food will still be here when you're done.
Yeah, I know food will still be here. He's really just that way. Just like, whatever. All right. And of course, Lou Costello Eats Freshly Poured Cat Food, our fake sponsor. Whether you serve Pet Store Perfection or Dollar Store Dreck, your cats will sit on the kitchen floor and demand that the food they eat is only freshly poured.
Freshly poured, freshly poured.
And you can send your internet kitty, dog, sheep, iguana, fish,
llama,
anything, any pet you have, to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We do love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write to us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go, Postal Unions! Letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. This is not charity. This is our job. This week we have a science fiction university up.
We do.
And we were also on the Bill Show.
We were.
This week. And Bill from Australia, he is a radio guy. He is hilarious and entertaining, and he always provides us with a game show to play, and we have so much fun on his show.
We do. It's the before and after show is awful fun too.
Yeah, and we just love him. So if you look up the Bill Show, expat progressive, you'll find it. He's
Australia.
On Spotify, I think. Yeah. Go look that up. It's there, and we just had a ball. If you haven't had enough Drift Glass and Bluegill this week, go check out the Bill Show, our appearance on that, and we had just a blast. If you can spare $5 a month, please spare $5 a month. We would really appreciate it. Patreon.com/proleftpod is where you can support the show. We need it, we appreciate it, and we love you. Please share our show on social media, and if you love this podcast, please get someone else to listen to, and thank you so much for doing that.
Oh, a piece of information. I got feedback from appearing on the Bradcast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They had the only place they'd ever heard me is on the Bradcast.
Oh.
And I had promoted the Professional Left Podcast, our No Fair Remembering Stuff Professional Left Podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And they came over and listened to it. And they said, this is awesome. This is great. and I now I need to set aside a month to listen to this thing. But they told Brad that, you know, they had checked us out thanks to being on that and us mentioning it there.
Yeah.
And that they thought OG bloggers are amazing. And OG bloggers who were right about stuff are amazing. And I was deeply touched because they routed it through Brad, who gave it to me, saying, hey, amigo, you got some fan mail. Cool.
And so, Driftglass, speaking of this is our job, Driftglass is going to watch the entire Hugh Hewitt Third Republican debate for the broadcast.
Yeah. The things I do for
England. I'm not going to watch it.
No. No.
I'm probably going to have to watch a little bit of it.
Yeah. But. No, you'll be in the other room knitting and watching, I don't know, Lost in Space or
I'll
something.
I'll be hate watching The Gilded Age. That's what I'll be doing.
So painful.
It's so bad.
Yet she watches it. Oh, by the way, the Science Fiction University is about time travel, about the paradox of time travel, a very specific kind of paradox, because we watched Bodies together.
Bodies on Netflix, which is a good show. We recommend that. Yeah.
We really enjoy it. Anyway.
Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, honestly, Blue Gal, the internet kitties are feeling pretty young compared to your 19-year-old blog.
Well, thanks a lot, internet kitties.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
Let's think about loving.
Think about loving.
Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, loving, loving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2023, DGBG Productions.